Episode 119 of Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world manage risk and seize opportunities. Learn more at futuresfundamentals.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hey everyone, before we get started today, I want to thank our sponsors, CME Group and Trading Technologies. Today I spoke to someone who graduated from Indiana University and started immediately as an analyst. Became a wheat trader in 1980 at the Chicago Board of Trade with Pillsbury and eventually went on to trade with Transmarket Group for 13 years. Moved on to Kansas City to trade on the Kansas City Board of Trade and continues to trade wheat electronically to this day. Today I spoke with Q Hawthorne. Today, Q and I spoke about the evolution of trading in the ag markets, from the pits to the screens. And now Q believes that artificial intelligence is going to be the next generation of trading. We discussed why the economics of the ag markets in 2008, 10, and 12 created a problem for farmers and traders in the U.S., and Q tells us how he sees the ag markets today. Q talks about a statistical approach to trading markets and gave us some insight on China and Russia. It was a blast speaking with Q. We shared similar backgrounds starting in the pits and moving on to electronic trading. Whether you are a commodity trader or focused on fixed income and equities, you will love hearing Q's insight on trading the markets. Thank you all for listening, and please enjoy this episode. Q, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I love having ex-floor traders on my show, and I really enjoy hearing how ex-floor traders got started in the business. So before we begin talking about the topics today that we have for you, Q, can you please tell us how you got your start in the industry and take us through your journey up to now where you are the research director and co-founder for Stats Futures?
Okay, well, it's been a long journey. Came out of Indiana University, straight into the OIA at the Chicago Board of Trade, and was a financial analyst, working my way up to be head of market analysis at the Board of Trade, where I was the lead investigator during the Hunt Silver crisis in 79 and 80, after which time I became a wheat trader for the first time on the floor with Pillsbury here in Chicago, and that was where I got my start. So March 3rd, 1980 was my first day on the floor, and began this long journey that I've been on. And I was part of a devastating trading team there in Pillsbury back in those days, from 80 to 83, after which time I joined Transmarket Group as one of the co-founding trading partners with Ray Kahneman and Bill Feldman, and spent 12, 13 years with those guys building up the grain side of the business while Ray was running their massive financial business on the other side of the building. After that, I took my business, and since I'm a wheat trader and a big intermarket spreader, I took my business and my family. We moved down to Kansas City, bought a seat down there, and essentially flipped my business and started trading Kansas City wheat from the Kansas City Board of Trade and Chicago wheat. So I just flipped the business and moved my business and family down here. Spent 5 years doing that, and then retired from the trading floors and got back into some of the more analytical things that I've done in my life, and built some financial engineering supply chain management software, filed for a couple of patents, went to teach statistics in the Indiana University system, and then the one thing that's been on the back of my mind since about 1992 was electronic large-scale spread trading of all the wheat markets, so Kansas City, Chicago, Minneapolis. And I've taken that time right now, the last few years, to be building that with an outfit in New York. I've also built a grains hedging app that's going into an ag tech operation in Champaign-Urbana in the next couple of months, and working on a couple other things that are on the drawing boards. and setting up a mentoring program for some, you know, I would say intermediate kind of traders that seems to be missing today in the marketplace.
Well, a lot has changed since 1980, and obviously you've seen a dramatic shift from where we were on the trading floors to where we are now electronically. So I want to begin today about talking about the evolution of the industry. You know, since you've gone through that and you've had to adapt and change like myself and a lot of other traders, talk to us about what you've had to do to remain successful in the ever-changing environment in the futures industry.
Sure thing, Tony. You know, I'm one of the few traders that actually started on the old grain trading floor. I actually remember blackboards, and the guys were up there with chalk. So they did that, but the electronic boards were running. But, of course, the Board of Trade never fired anybody back in those days. And so, you know, I remember those days. I remember tax trading. I remember the evolution of that. I remember when we went, you know, the 86 tax bill. So, you know, the key thing is you have to adapt because the marketplace changes. The players somewhat change, but yet it's the game that changes, and you've got to adapt quickly to it. And, you know, the one thing that really stuck out to me, like I was saying about 1992, I was standing on the floor, and it became clear to me that Project A was going to become the way we did business in the future. So, you know, being a mathematician, you know, scientist sort of background, you know, I knew that I was going to be able to survive and thrive, and I continued to work on those skills to be able to adapt to the current marketplace we find ourselves in today.
What did you enjoy more? Did you enjoy the floor more, or do you enjoy what you're doing now more?
You know, the thing is, I really enjoyed the floor because, you know, believe you me, I was back there with the legends in the wheat trade, and I learned from the best, you know, best in the business. But today, at my age, it's great that I could sit here and do my thing. I don't envy a young trader having to come in and learn this business without somebody, you know, sort of guiding them along like I was helped out. It's really, you know, I was at the right place at the right time for pretty much everything in the last 35 years.
And that's why I always tell our traders, I say, look, I'm always an advocate for getting a mentor, getting someone out there that can help you, because I learn from watching other people do it. I learn from watching other people become successful at trading. And in this day and age, we're alone out there, right? You're at your computer, although we have Twitter and we have other things where we can engage in conversations. It's not the same as actually being physically next to people. And if we don't do that, I know because that's hard in a world where we have traders all across the world now, but at least to engage with, you know, some personal conversations with people, I can't say enough about how that's helped me. And obviously hearing from you, it helped you as well. Let's move on and talk a little bit about something that you had said to me and I thought was very interesting. You know, a lot of people talk about 2008 as the financial crash, right? But you said 2008, 2010, and 2012 were actually the worst things that could have happened to farmers and the ag industry. So can you please explain to us why you believe that is, and tell us, where do you see the current state of farmers in the ag industry?
Okay. You know, we got a saying in economics that high prices cure high prices. But insanely high prices bring about competition. And if you think about 2008 in wheat, when we put spring wheat up to $24 a bushel and red wheat up to $13, $14 a bushel, you know, what happened was that it signaled to everybody in the world that they need to get their acreage together and plant wheat. And what happened after that was that we see the wheat market that we got today as a direct result of 2008 on a global scale. 2010 and 2012, you know, with the Russian problems in 10 and the drought in 12, you know, put corn to, you know, 750 and 838 a bushel, has brought in, you know, everybody, you know, everybody's gotten their acreage going. So what we see now is we see a situation where we've got competition in Russia for grain business. And believe you me, I remember standing out in the cornfields in 1974 in Indiana, and if you would have told me that 40 years later Russia was going to sell more wheat than we did, I'd have said you're out of your mind. But that's exactly what's happened, is that these high prices have opened up the economic avenues for our competitors to really plant this stuff. And of course, the strengthening of the dollar, because of, you know, our economy is doing better than theirs in the global trading system, has only exacerbated the problem. And the same thing goes with soybeans. You know, we had in 2013 we put beans up to about, what, 15, 16, 17, 18 bucks. And now they're opening up new lands in Brazil, they're opening up shipping lanes, they're opening up transport lanes. Russia's got another 40 million hectares, whatever the heck a hectare is. I think it's like 2 acres of land that they can open up to corn and wheat production. So the thing is that once this happens, business is going to, let's say, North Africa or to China, and all of a sudden we have competitors, but we're at a huge freight disadvantage because we're sitting over here with an ocean on either side of us. And this is the world that we find ourselves at this moment, is because corn, beans, and wheat are in the crapper, but yet they're sitting here and they're doing nothing. And this reminds me so much of 1985, getting back to, knowing someone who knows, like the last 30 or 40 years as opposed to the last 10 in the trading business. So what we've got is a situation where the farmers are at cost of production or under, and the global economy is telling them for the next year or two, barring a drought, this is it. So, it's almost like what has happened to the Saudis with their, $142 barrel oil in 2008 has brought about the shale fields up in North Dakota, and, of course, the new shale fields in Texas we just found. So, insanely high prices brought about competition, and now the Saudis are suffering, as are our farmers.
I was going to say, before you had said it, that it reminds me a lot of what happened in oil. So talk to me from a trading perspective. Are you doing more fundamental analysis, more technical analysis, or a combination of both?
It's a combination of both, but, I infuriate a lot of my buddies on Twitter because I'm to the point now where I actually feel what the market wants to do.
So you go off of feel. So your trading is off of feel. Just, is it momentum feel, or what is the basis of it? Just by, just watching the tape?
Well, what I do is, statistics. I do a lot of statistical work, which provides me with what I call ranges of where the market's going. And if you think about it, it's like you're driving down the road, and these are the white lines you get to drive between. And there's like a 95 to 97% chance that you're going to be staying on that road. And given that road, you can tell where the market's going to go. And, once you feel the market, like today, wheat's getting hammered, down about a nickel. And, it's been in this trading range where it's just balancing in between back and forth. But we don't see any, the market doesn't want to break out one way or the other in a big way. So it's what I call trading action. And, fundamentally, day traders can sit here. I got a lot of guys that I talk with who are, I talk about, POCs, point of controls and VWAPs and all that kind of stuff. But, I pretty much just know where the market's going to go. And I guess that's where 30 years of just watching this thing has led me to.
No, I could totally relate to that. I talk about my strategy a lot as well. I too look at ranges. It's like, just give me a range as to where I think that they're boxed in and trade. And a lot of what I'm doing, is discretionary by things that I've seen happen in the past. And although the industry is constantly changing, some things really don't change, right, Q? Like movements, even though you've talked about what's happened from 1985, remembering a scenario and bringing that to modern day, markets tend to have similar movements under certain circumstances.
People are people, and that's why Fibonacci's work.
I love it how you say it. People are people, and it's so true. Behind all of these machines that people talk about in the trading world are still people helping those machines make some of those decisions. So you have some interesting thoughts on China and Russia. You said macro thoughts. Can you please share those with us?
Well, I see China. If you look at what has happened, from 2005 to now, I consider that like a microcosm of a world shift. And they went from like having 100 million plus or minus hogs to over 500 or 600 million now. And what has happened is they've gotten to a point where they want to be, and now they're getting their feed rations and everything else settled out. And we're seeing them start to commit more acres to beans and less to cotton. And, they're famous for wanting to be self-sufficient like they did in corn and wheat, because back in 1980, the big buyer of wheat was China, and we don't sell diddly to them, by comparison these days. So I'm looking at down the future for China to be doing that, which is to get themselves self-sufficient on beans. I'm also looking at this larger macro structure I'm beginning to sense out there, that as America becomes more and more energy independent, we're going to see China and Russia having to defend the oil lanes. that we're just not going to waste too much more blood and treasure, in my opinion, over there in the Middle East to get oil going from here to there or from there to here. So that's why I'm thinking we're seeing, you know, Chinese military posture. We're seeing the shipping lanes. They're protecting those. They're building those islands to protect the shipping lanes and everything else. So, that's my thought as to why I'm seeing what I'm seeing. A lot of people are saying, China, blah, 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 and all this other kind of stuff with military and everything else. And of course, the other thing they're doing, I think, is I think this North Korea business is more of a mosquito sting to kind of keep us thinking about something else while they're continuing their plans. And of course, they just finished the Silk Road situation where they're going to be shipping grain in and out of Kazakhstan and Ukraine and stuff like that, which is back to my point about U.S. being freight disadvantaged over here when it comes to grains. And of course, we've got the oil and gas deals with Russia coming out of Siberia. So you see what they're doing is they're preparing their economy, not necessarily what Americans want, but what's in their own best interest. And that's the way I like to look at other countries is they do what they do, and nobody really wants to get into a shooting war. It's just that we're going to rub shoulders and get agitated at each other once in a while, but I don't think it's really serious at the moment.
So take us through a trade scenario with something that you're talking about with China and Russia. What may be something that triggers to where you're like, okay, I'm going to start looking at this trade? Like, is there any trades that come off of what you spoke about?
Well, I think that you got to keep your eyes on soybeans. I mean, soybeans are the key right now because, wheat, we're essentially a marginal supplier of wheat. We're getting that way in corn, especially with South America coming on. If Brazil gets another couple of big states opened up to corn and bean production with that new Panama Canal shipping lane opening up, things are going to get really interesting for American farmers, trust me. So, what I'm seeing now is I'm seeing beans teetering here at $10. Everybody keeps talking $12, $13. My numbers show that that's an extremely unlikely probability of something like that happening. And, I'm hearing whispers of lower numbers, but, I still tend to think at this moment with the crop going in the ground, we're going to keep things, plus or minus here at the moment, around $10. But once it becomes clear, then I think beans are going to have to move to the market, which is probably not going to be a pretty thing.
Gotcha. Great stuff today, Q. Now, I have some rapid-fire segment questions. Are you ready for those?
Sure.
All right, everyone. Our rapid-fire segment is sponsored by Trading Technologies. Trade the global markets from virtually anywhere with TT, the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. Create your account and try it now free at tryttnow.com. Q, first question. How has your trading evolved over the years?
I've gone to a much more computerized and statistical viewpoint of the markets. Whereas when I used to stand in the pits, I would start to get feel from other players around me. Without that, it's really a mathematical view of the markets at the moment.
Can you tell me that the moment trading just clicked for you?
That would be spring of 1985. Markets were compressed. Spreads were down. A big player from Korea came in and wanted to do a huge bear spread in the deep back options, all the way at the back. And I gave him a near limit position there, and it was one of those moments of truth. And it turns out I was dead right. So, it all clicked with my analytics and everything else. And I'm more of a counterpuncher. And, you always have to wait for that moment. And if you get it and you do it, then that's hugely satisfying.
What's the number one source you spend your time on?
Twitter.
What's your favorite book about trading or the markets?
I've got to say Art of War.
What's your favorite movie or even TV show about trading or the markets?
I got to say The Big Short. It used to be Trading Places, but The Big Short's a little more apropos.
What's the best piece of advice you've received about trading or the markets?
Quit getting emotional.
Now, if you can give a piece of advice to the new people interested in getting involved in trading, what would it be?
Get a mentor and quit being emotional.
Now, if you weren't a trader, you'd be what?
I'd be a galactic astrophysicist.
Great stuff today, Q. Before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to add to today's show?
In this business, I've evolved, you know, a great deal, and you know, I'm really enjoying building models and this stuff and heading into what I consider to be the new future, which is AI. And, you know, my company and I are thinking about putting out a mentoring program. So, you know, that's the only thing that I really see where I can build a little bit of my teaching skills from Indiana University and bring this to bear and help some students out, or students, I call you young trader students, like I did my college students. And, you know, bring this to a complete close, because I think that AI trading is really going to be the end-all be-all in the next 10 years.
Wow, Q, thank you so much for coming on Futures Radio Show today. I really enjoyed speaking with you and hearing about these important topics in the industry, and I look forward to speaking with you again in the future on Futures Radio Show.
Anytime.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.